Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, parenting in the U.S. when you're an immigrant, which often comes with its own set of challenges and questions, like how to react when your child does not want to learn your native language or rejects your lovingly made tiffin or bento in favor of a PB&J, or complains that you're putting too much pressure on them to succeed. This hour, we talk with parents navigating the obstacles and the opportunities of raising a child far from the country they came from. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're often more likely to hear the experiences and perspectives of the children of immigrants than of the immigrant parents themselves trying to raise their kids in America. Masha Rumer, who came to the U.S. from the Soviet Union when she was 13 years old, felt acutely this lack of stories and representation of immigrant parents after the birth of her first child. To fill that void, she's written Parenting with an Accent, which inspired today's segment. This hour, we'll hear from parents navigating the challenges of raising a child in a country far from where they were born. And if this is you, we want to hear from you. Tell us the hard, the weird, the wonderful that comes with being an immigrant parent. Masha Rumer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mina.
So your book, it has stories of immigrant parenting that are sometimes funny, sometimes sad, from parents actually all over the world. But is there one that comes to mind from your own experience where you think it really captures the challenges that immigrant parents face?
Yes. When my daughter was just turned 3 years old and my son was just a few months old, we were the holiday season was upon us and it was around Christmas time. And when we were driving in the car, I put on a song from my own winter holiday tradition, which is called "В лесу родилась елочка" in Russian. It's basically, it's completely secular. It has nothing to do with Christianity because everybody in the Soviet Union celebrated the calendar, basically, December 31st. So it was similar to Christmas, but without any religious traditions assigned to it. And so I put the song on for my daughter and she says, "What is that song?" And I was like, "Yes, I'm going to tell my daughter all about my traditions and my holidays." And I said, "Oh, it's a Russian holiday song because you're a Russian girl, right?" And she said, "No, I'm an English girl and I want another Jingle Bells that my daddy listens to." So it was like, oh, denied. So that was really hard. And of course I didn't keep playing the song, but later on, I remember going to a grocery store a few hours later and just getting really misty and even having trouble shopping for like vegetables because I was overcome with a sense of, you know, feeling rejected and kind of lonely. And like my children are not into my heritage at all. And a huge part of my past is being lost. That's how it felt.
Did you anticipate that this would be so important to you when you were having your child? And what I mean by that is that this desire to basically grip your Russian culture more tightly after becoming a parent.
You know, I didn't really anticipate that at all. I came here when I was a teenager, so I've lived here for most of my life. I'm married to an American, you know, English is a language that we speak to one another. But when my daughter was born, I suddenly just could not speak English to her at all. It had to be Russian, which was, you know, I didn't expect that. And that's exactly how we started bringing her up, me speaking Russian to her in the first few months of her life.
Yeah, it's interesting. You considered yourself, I guess, very, quote, Americanized at that point, having been here since you were 13.
Right. So it was very unexpected. And it wasn't just the language, of course. And a language is a huge part. I mean, it's how we, you know, identify ourselves. It's the memories, it's the people we love that we may have not seen since we've moved here, or, you know, have stayed in the old country. But it was also the traditions, the music, the cartoons. They suddenly, I was just overcome and flooded with all these feelings of longing and nostalgia. Even though I'm an immigrant, you know, it's not a political thing. You know, there was a reason I'm here and not back in Russia or the former Soviet Union. But those personal experiences of home and my own childhood were suddenly just very raw to me. And I really wanted to share them with my kids.
Yeah. And I mentioned that there were very few resources or things that you could find that kind of reflected back that experience of being an immigrant parent, right? That you felt very alone. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's exactly. It's I suddenly found myself feeling quite isolated. And I know that identity crises and the feeling of isolation is a very normal thing for parents of, you know, no matter where they're from, you know, especially lately when we're becoming much more isolated, even before COVID. But yes, I really wished there was a resource for me to, you know, to relate to and to feel less like I'm, you know, like a strange person straddling two cultures. There was definitely loneliness. I wished I had some bilingualism resources as well. But I did find some really great resources on how to raise a bilingual child, but they seemed very regimented. Like if you have to do, you know, steps 1, 2, 3, but it's very hard to follow all those steps exactly. And then at one point you just feel like, you know, maybe like you're messing up or you're not trying hard enough or your child is suddenly not into it at all. And then you kind of give up altogether. It's really frustrating. So I didn't find any nonfiction kind of resources that reflected my experience and also the experience of other immigrants, no matter where they're from, the more I started talking about it. And that's how the idea for the book came about.
Yeah. So mom groups, it sounds like, weren't really cutting it for you in terms of being support systems.
I think the mom group has its own culture. Obviously, there's so many wonderful things about them, but I guess it also depends on whether the people share your experience. And I think being an immigrant, and it also, of course, depends on when a person comes to the United States, right, as an adult or as a little child. But yeah, there's a bit of like a shape-shifting happening. And obviously, people who are multicultural or bicultural are good at, you know, trying to adapt to one culture or the other, same as the language. But some things we just can't really adapt to, or we can act on it. But especially when you have, you know, certain like pop culture references or childhood references, it's very isolating. I had a few of those experiences, you know, even though I was meeting very nice people, I just felt like a fish out of water in many ways.
Did you ever do things that for your own baby that your parent did for you that got looks or stares?
Yes, I still do. I must confess, I'm always thinking that they're like really hungry and that they're cold. So I make them wear slippers and they each have a few pairs so that they don't walk around barefoot in the house. And I'm always joking, you know, guys, when you grow up and go to college, I'm going to be living right next to you, rent a little apartment and make sure you wear slippers. And then I'm like, maybe I'm actually serious. I don't think that's a joke. I might actually do that. And that's a very cultural thing that, you know, having grown up in a very cold climate and not always had enough food. So that's kind of where it came from.
You also had this very poignant story about trying to show your daughter Russian flashcards. Can you just tell us a little bit about that experience, especially as you were referencing earlier, kind of the regimented, like these are the steps you need to do to have your child learn another language.
Yeah, so I was able to buy these flashcards on Amazon. And of course, resources, I should say, are also very important, like, you know, books and flashcards are so critical to stimulating the language development, plus videos, of course, too. So I finally found those really cool flashcards. And I was showing them, but instead of actually enjoying the cards, my daughter, maybe it was my son, they just ended up scrawling all over it. And like not really wanting to speak the language, especially I would say when they started going full-time to an American daycare and being surrounded by the language. And of course, when the kids are in a monolingual environment, no matter like how much our parents want them to speak the heritage language, they're just more self-conscious and want to be like everybody else. And that's when the language started to be kind of rejected at that point.
When you think about all these things that you've tried to do, the reasons that it's so important for you that your child is connected to your Russian heritage, what do you think it all boils down to? Is it just this desire for like a real deep closeness and not feeling like that's possible without these connections to you?
I think that's a really great way of putting it. And that's something I also found in my interviews that I did for the book with other parents and even non-parents. There are some non-parents that I spoke to as well. So it definitely, I mean, there's so many benefits of bilingualism, and we hear about them all the time, right? There's, you know, the cognitive benefit, there's, you know, the multitasking, there's the people are more empathetic, but in the end, it's not really about that. It's the ability to be, to speak to, you know, the grandparents who might, in some cases, might not be able to speak English at all. It's the ability to one day travel abroad and, you know, meet the family they may have never met and just understand those experiences in this very intimate way. And some jokes that cannot be translated, the, you know, the wealth of songs, the recipes, the, just the cultural heritage. And it's definitely not just like, oh, I can do, you know, 20 pushups versus five. It's not about like an ability. It's something so personal to so many people, having that connection.
You mentioned earlier that your spouse is US born. I'm so curious if there are things that partners can do to really share the responsibility of passing on, you know, one of the partner's cultures.
That's a really great question. From what I found, and just having spoken to some psychologists about this for the book, is that it's not necessary for the partner to learn the native language of their spouse. I think it all just boils down to an open mind and, of course, accepting the person's heritage, not belittling it. Oftentimes, actually all the time, kids are so receptive to the attitudes that they hear about their heritage and their language, and the heritage transmission might be easily affected by the negativity. So really just being open and appreciative. And of course, it doesn't hurt to learn a few words.
Well, Perry writes, I'm from Turkey and miss my large extended family of cousins, aunts, uncles, and friends who are close, so we call them cousins. There is always someone watching out for your child in that culture. Here, it is just the family. And I think that is a missed opportunity. Did you hear that a lot from parents you interviewed?
Oh, absolutely. That was just such a huge part. I think community is really what kind of one of the central themes of my book. I heard of parents, I mean, not just struggling with isolation and identity crisis when they became parents, but also just missing the connection. For example, one parent I spoke to was from India, and she said that, you know, she got married back in India, and then immediately they moved to the United States. But she just did not want to have kids. And not until a few years later, when they moved close to her family and they had that kind of a similar environment to how she grew up, she was not willing to have children of her own because community was so important to her. And so many other stories like that.
We're talking with Masha Rumer, author of Parenting with an Accent, about the experiences of raising children in the U.S. as an immigrant. And you can join the conversation. Are you an immigrant parent? What challenges have you faced raising kids here? Or which traditions have you tried to preserve, maybe even leave behind? 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. We'll have more with Masha Rumer and more parents after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. One in four U.S. children have immigrant parents. And today we're exploring the struggles of parenting when you've been raised in a different culture. We're talking with Masha Rumer, the author of Parenting with an Accent. And you, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. Are you an immigrant parent? What challenges have you faced raising kids in America? As immigrant parents, which traditions have you tried to preserve? Have you left any behind? Taka writes, a tradition I left behind was celebrating Reyes Magos with a materialistic gift. Now we don't give presents. The tradition I keep is one special favorite meal once a week. The biggest challenge as a Latino immigrant mom of a mixed-race boy in the San Francisco public school district is to aid parents not proficient in English to have a voice at school and at PTA meetings where decisions for the future of the school are being made. I want to bring into the conversation now Connie Chang, a freelance journalist who wrote the New York Times article, Connecting My Children to Their Heritage in Mandarin. Connie Chang, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mina. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And you're slightly different from Masha in the sense that you're actually the child of immigrants, now raising children yourself. So you grew up in the U.S. in California, actually?
Yeah, in the Bay Area, actually. Yep.
Oh, so what language did you speak in the house? Like, how were your parents' immigrant traditions sort of shared with you?
So I grew up speaking just Mandarin until I reached preschool age. And then I started preschool not knowing any English, which I don't quite remember, but my parents said that I was pretty bold. I went in and within, I think a few months, I was able to speak English pretty well. Mm-hmm. So in our household, it was, even though we were in America, it felt very much like we were still Chinese. Mm. My parents, we shopped at Asian grocery markets in both San Francisco and San Jose. I went to Chinese school on Saturdays. So a lot of those traditions were still intact.
So did you feel internally like one of those cultures between American and Chinese began fighting for primacy and that one eventually won out?
Yeah, it was confusing, I think, for me, because in some ways I felt really, really different from my peers. I knew that on Saturdays I couldn't watch Saturday morning cartoons. I missed out on some slumber parties because I had to go to Chinese school. And, you know, when I was younger, I didn't question it. But as I got older, I definitely rebelled against it. And I think around second grade, even though I continued to go to Chinese school until I was around 15, I pretty much rejected it. So my parents would talk to me in Chinese and I would respond in English.
Mm. So then what happened, Connie, when you had a kid?
So yeah, when I had a kid, I mean, a lot of things change when you have children, right? I mean, it's a huge shift for most people. And I just suddenly, you know, I think it was a few months before my daughter was born. I just realized that it was really important for me to instill in her some of my background, some of my, the fact that Chinese is the first language I grew up speaking. So I made a very conscious decision to try to speak to her in Mandarin only for the first, you know, first few months of her life, only to realize that, you know, I had forgotten a lot of my Chinese. So that was a very unpleasant realization. So like my daughter is 10 now and I have two other children. In the intervening years, I've learned along with them and a lot of that language is coming back to me. So I guess for me, it was a very conscious decision to incorporate some of the traditions of my earlier life into their present. Yep.
I'm curious about what you were saying about like being surprised at how much you had not remembered the Mandarin. I think one of the things that kids of immigrant parents who still want their kids, even if they were born in the U.S. or not in the country, the home country of their parents, that they still want to pass on that heritage to them, but they feel this sort of like once removed nature of it, almost like it was filtered to them and then their kids will have it filtered again to them and that it won't be like this really rich or full version of the culture. And I definitely know for me, that's been something I've thought about a lot. And I've been worried about whether I'm doing, you know, that part of my kid's identity, like a disservice, right? Because I feel sort of once removed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's the experience of a lot of us second generation immigrants, is that we feel that, you know, a lot of that culture, a lot of that language even has been diluted. It's, you know, we have this desire to pass it on, But on the other hand, we don't know it very well either. Like, I feel like growing up, I kind of got a hodgepodge of that culture. Like, I was very into the red envelopes that we get during, you know, Chinese New Year. I liked getting money from my right. parents and elders. But then other celebrations, like the, you know, the first 100 days after a baby is born, there's a huge celebration celebrating the first 3 months of life. Like, things like that I've lost. And I just feel like I really want my children to be able to know a fuller picture of that culture. And as you pointed out, it's hard for me. So I've outsourced some of that. When my kids were growing up, we had a nanny who was from mainland China. And of course, my parents are still in the Bay Area, so they talk to them as much as possible. And yeah, I'm just doing my best to try to pass along an imperfect picture of my culture.
We're talking with Connie Chang, a freelance journalist, and also Tomasha Rumer, author of Parenting with an Accent. You, our listeners, are with us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email address forum at kqed.org. Reach us on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum. Mary in Richmond, join us. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to share our story. I'm an immigrant. I came here when I was a teenager from Ethiopia, and I married a French man whom I met in college. And so now we have two children, and we're trying to pass on both heritages. And it's been difficult. But my husband has been very strict about speaking only French to our kids, and now they can speak French. And we've been fortunate to put them into French schools, so we have that going. But I wanted to share that for me, it was important to also just communicate with them in one language and share, you know, jokes, and not be about me passing on my language and, you know, be adamant about that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, you know, I didn't want another third language, and then, you know, then I wasn't sure what we would communicate in. So I consciously kind of gave that up. We had a nanny for a year who was Ethiopian, and she kind of helped me instill that language, culture, and food. So that was really nice. So they are kind of exposed to my culture, and we get to travel whenever we can. But, you know, I was just wondering if other immigrant parents are, you know, have this difficulty of, you know, whether to pass on their heritage or language, or how much significance is there in just being able to communicate with one language, you know, and if that sacrifice might be necessary sometimes.
You know what, Connie, I'm going to go back to you on that. Thanks, Mary. That's a very sweet story and a great question, because I read in your article that your husband is Italian.
That's right. Yeah.
So how do you navigate in terms of learning languages and passing on one language versus another? And I don't know that Mary's bringing up.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So my husband is a first generation immigrant from Italy. So for us, it's also very important that we pass along his Italian culture as well. When my daughter was born, he did speak to her in Italian, but as she got older, it became really difficult to sort of maintain both languages plus English. So we made the conscious decision to back off on Italian for now, with the idea that Mandarin is a little bit more difficult to learn, so it's best to get the harder language in first. Something I definitely want to revisit, and we visit his family in Italy whenever we can. Unfortunately, the pandemic has put a crimp in that, sure. But it's definitely something that we're conscious of. And he's been very supportive of my desire to pass along the Mandarin culture to them as well. So that's been very helpful.
Well, let me thank Mary again. And another Mary writes, I came to the U.S. 50 years ago to raise my kids, who I'm very proud of. The struggles for me were language. It took me a long time to be able to express myself in English. In Korean, I am witty. In English, I am just another person speaking it as a second language, but it's better. The hardest part was dealing with the racism. I never liked it for myself, but it broke my heart to watch my kids experience it. In Korea, they would never have experienced this, but I consoled myself thinking there was a bigger goal. Now with race racism today, it feels like the 1960s all over again. But still, I'm glad we came because my children have rich and fulfilling lives, and I do too. Mashroom, I'm curious if parents you spoke with talked about this, either seeing their own children experience racism, or one of the things that I know that I've heard a lot is just how painful it is for parents when someone is racist towards them and their kids witness it, especially when they're trying to instill a pride in their heritage culture.
That is just a heartbreaking story, Mary. I'm sorry that you and your kids have experienced it. And unfortunately, you know, it's still often very much a reality. I mean, there was such, for example, 100 years ago, there was a huge like nativism movement. Bilingual kids were supposed, you know, considered to be like, you know, mentally not on the same level as monolingual English speaking kids. And there was this huge push against immigrants, which eventually like choked off immigration for like decades. And unfortunately, we did see some of that reappear in recent years. Definitely, if, you know, we come to a new country, we want to preserve the language. But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of people who might be looking at it funny or, you know, mistrusting us, and definitely our children. And if our children see that, then they're like, oh, something must be wrong with this language, because they're so receptive to the environment. I did, you know, I spoke to quite a few people. One example I can think of is a woman from the Detroit area who came from Iraq when she was a baby. They were fleeing persecution. They're Chaldean. And she used to be, like many immigrant kids, a translator for her parents. So they would go grocery shopping and she would be speaking Arabic to, or Chaldean, to her mother. And she told me about an incident that the woman basically just accosted them at the store. She said, "What are you saying? Stop speaking this language. This is America. You got to speak English now." But, you know, she somehow was able to say, you know, this is, you know, this is my language and I'm an American. I speak this language because I'm proud of it. So back off, lady. Mm-hmm. And so she handled it very well. And actually, she told me that she was able to preserve the native language in her home as an adult. Unfortunately, not so much with her own kids now, but it's a very much a recurring theme and it's very painful. And it, of course, it does affect language transmission. One thing I'll say is, Connie, I love the article that you wrote when it came out about your preservation of Mandarin. And it's so great that you're using all these resources, but it's really challenging, especially since it takes three generations for us to lose a native language. I was just like floored when I heard those statistics, because we as immigrants, first generation, we speak it. Our kids are typically bilingual and our grandkids tend to be monolingual, so lose that language connection. Mm. So it's not necessarily like us that are maybe feel like we're failing. It's just the circumstances. It's not so easy to preserve that heritage language, but of course we can do the best we can if we try.
Yeah. A couple more thoughts on language from listeners. Carmina writes, "My mom is from Mexico and she said it was more important to her to only speak English to us kids so we wouldn't have any speech issues at grade school. The only time we heard her speak in Spanish was when she was swearing at our dad." Susan writes, "I have always been very sorry that my father, born in the Ukraine, Russia at that time, who spoke Yiddish, never taught us to use his language as well. I hope others allow their children to learn their language. It's a big addition to their lives, whatever the language." Well, on the line now, we have Rajika Bhandari. Rajika, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Mina. Thank you for having me.
Rajika Bhandari is author of America Calling, a Foreign Student in a Country of Possibility. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1992 from New Delhi, lives with her daughter and mother in New York. And Rajika, I have to say that's one of the things that I was really struck by, that you and your daughter do live with your mother now. And I am just so curious what effect that's had on the dynamics in your household in terms of passing on culture.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, Mina, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think one of the aspects of many immigrant households in the US that often goes unobserved, yet is quite widespread, is that many immigrant households are multi-generational. And in fact, when we look at the rise of multi-generational households in the US, I believe the statistic is that almost a quarter of all households in the US are now multi-generational, and it's that's found most often actually in Asian and Hispanic families, and of course, large immigrant groups within those communities. And so we are a multi-generational family, and I think that adds a whole new layer of complexity to many of the dynamics that Marcia and Kani were already talking about. But perhaps I can add something new, which is that as an immigrant parent, you're already struggling with ideas of how do you bring up your child? How do you, what are notions of discipline? And, you know, I grew up within the Indian culture in India, and the style of upbringing was certainly much more authoritarian than what's what one would find now in US society. And so there's already that struggle of how do you sort of find a balance between what you know.
Does your mom think you're not being strict enough with your child?
Exactly. Exactly. And then you bring in sort of you know, the other generation and a grandparent, and that can lead to a lot of self-doubt, a lot of second guessing for a parent on, you know, are you doing this right? Are you bringing your child up the right way? So I think that's one struggle. And I often find myself sort of being the buffer, being the sandwich generation, but certainly sort of handling those dynamics between the older generation, which has not necessarily evolved or grown in any way in the US. I mean, for me, I came to the US when I was 21. So unlike Connie and Marcia, I was already an adult, but I was still young enough for you know, my subsequent values and beliefs to also be shaped by my time in the US, which wasn't necessarily true for my mom. So I think, there are many immigrant families that are multi-generational, and it's an angle that's just not explored often enough.
We're coming up on a break, but I'm curious, Rajika, has it made you wonder sometimes if you're too hard on your own kid?
Yes. And so I think there is that was the second guessing part that I was talking about, because it's not just about the older generation. It's also how I've grown up. And there's, of course, the myth of, the tiger mom and all sorts of, you know, other similarities. But yes, I think I fall within that group as well to a small extent.
I see. So you backed off a little bit on the tendencies to really have your kids push themselves, for example, to really succeed. We're talking with Rajika Bhandari, author of America Calling, a Foreign Student in a Country of Possibility, who lives with her daughter and her mother in New York and immigrated to the U.S. in 92. Marcia Rumer is with us, author of Parenting with an Accent, who is a parent who immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 13 from the then Soviet Union. Connie Chang is with us, a freelance journalist who wrote the New York Times piece, Connecting My Children to Their Heritage in Mandarin. And we'll have more after the break, 866-733-6786 to join the conversation. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the nuances, the joys, the heartaches of raising children as an immigrant or a second-generation immigrant with Marcia Rumer, author of Parenting with an Accent, Rajika Bhandari, Connie Chang. And you, our listeners, are with us, 866-733-6786. Email address forum at kqed.org. Get in touch on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum, or post your thoughts on Instagram. Let me get to some more calls. Jenny in Miami. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you, Mina?
I'm well. What's on your mind, Jenny?
So I just wanted to call in and first say thank you for bringing light to this subject, because I think that there are many parents in the United States that are raising multilingual or bilingual, multicultural, bicultural kids. And it's having listening to other moms' stories that we can really relate and continue in this journey of raising our multilingual or bilingual kids. For me, it's been a little bit of a challenge raising my daughter bilingual and multilingual. My husband is Bulgarian. I was born in Colombia. I now live in the United States. And for me, the biggest issue has been not having the close proximity of immediate family to support the language and culture. Yeah. So for me, it's, and my husband is having to rely on resources online and, you know, trying to expand that network to help support our daughter so that she can identify with all of her cultures.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jenny. I really appreciate it. And that's definitely been something that's been underscored in other comments that we've heard today. For example, Joanna writes, I'm grateful that my children were able to experience several different cultures growing up. Or what remains foremost in my mind looking back is the regret that my children were not able to experience more time with their grandparents and extended family while growing up. I want to bring Dr. Juan Gaviria into the conversation now, a licensed marital and family therapist who specializes in working with first and second generation immigrant families. Dr. Gaviria, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a great conversation.
Oh, thanks. And I understand you yourself are an immigrant from El Salvador as well.
Yes, I am.
So as you've been listening to this conversation, I'm so curious. Well, first, can you tell us a little bit about the clients you tend to see and what are the issues that come up for them that maybe we haven't touched on yet?
So, yeah, a lot of the, you know, the stories that I heard in this conversation come up in my practice. So I work with a lot of young professionals, a lot of parents who are struggling with a lot of different issues. These are some of the issues that do come up. You have a lot of parents who are dealing with, you know, children who don't want to speak the language, who refuse to speak the language, sometimes a sense of shame about their cultural heritage. You know, parents like dealing with their own traumas and trying to raise a child kind of in a different culture. And sometimes the confusion that it creates when you don't understand the culture you're in and not knowing how to navigate this system, because there are no references or very little references to your own culture. So those are, you know, lack of access, like education, you know, we talked about like racism and things like that are things that show up in my practice when I work with parents.
I've been struck by some of the things that you said in terms of when parents are seeing their children really choosing, say, what they see as U.S. mainstream culture and even seeing it or even themselves realizing that their culture is viewed as less than in mainstream culture and kind of internalizing that. Can you talk about how you work through that with families?
Yeah, so it's an interesting experience. So, you know, when I was in my doing my doctoral dissertation, I was working with a lot of teenagers, and I was coming across this phenomena with teens and preteens who were really struggling with their cultural experience as American, and also as, you know, like if their heritage was from like Latin America or whatever. And there were times where it created this sense of confusion that I don't know where I belong. So for parents, it was confusing because they were trying to understand their children. And for the teens, it was like, I don't know where I belong. Like I don't consider myself American, but I also don't consider myself from, you know, whatever country their parents came from. And this created this really interesting dynamic in the children that they had to look outside of their own family to find a center. So a lot of times what they did was they looked at media. So you look at representation in media and they see like what is normal, right? So who sets the conditions to what is normal, which is dominant culture. So you see characters in video games that don't reflect them, characters in TV, on TV shows that don't reflect them. They look outside and they're looking at professionals that don't reflect them. They don't feel, they don't see themselves represented in the culture. And when they do, sometimes it was represented in a negative light. So sometimes the rejection of the culture, or like not wanting to identify, came from that. Like, I don't want to associate myself with, you know, whatever was being represented or not, because we all want to feel like there's a sense of belonging. Like, we all want to feel connected to something. So that was really interesting. And working with kids, it was about, and with parents, was about having them express what their experience was as Americans, right? So there has to be this redefinition of what American is outside of what the physical representation looks like. Because for a lot of people, what American is white, cis, and male.
You know, there are threads of what you're saying that I'm really struck by. One of the things is, it feels like almost the sense that you had to choose one or the other was at the core of this conflict. And what you were just saying now about what constitutes an American experience, I mean, one of the things I was struck by was the stat that I shared earlier, that 1 in 4 children have immigrant parents. And so this experience of navigating a bicultural, multicultural identity as the child of immigrants are themselves American experiences. They're like undeniably part of being American, I feel like you're getting at. They're not outside the American experience.
Yeah, but the thing is this, like, what's internalized is not that. So
right,
a child
exactly.
That, yeah, that's experiencing the world, you know, as an American child, it is an American experience. So like if a child writes a song in Spanish or in Korean or in Chinese or in Mandarin or in any language, it's still an American experience, but that's not how the world sees it. And that's not how they perceive it. They perceive it as foreign. So that's also like an internalized experience that they don't know how to deal with, because we don't have the language for that. That's not something we talk about.
Yeah. And you're helping bring that together, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, let me go to caller Judith in San Jose next. Hi, Judith. Thanks.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go right ahead.
So my experience is that I moved here in my teens from West Africa. And when I moved here, I was so into the American culture, because everything I saw, like the psychologist just said, you know, was the dominant culture. So I wanted so much to be American that I pushed back on my own culture. Mm. And so what I found was that as years went by and I wanted to have children, I started thinking, you know, like, you know what I was doing, you know, pushing back on that, didn't help me. And so it made me take a long time to have children, because I didn't have that community, you know, that I grew up in. And so I had ended up having children in my 40s. And I ended up just having one because of that. So it impacted me pretty good. And so when I had my child, I married a Jewish guy. And so there was that interracial thing going on, you know, we'll go out with our child and people would say, oh, are you the babysitter? Or you know, they didn't even think that it was my child, you know. And so she also looked at that like, oh, you know, maybe that's not, you know, good enough. And I could see that that affected her as well, you know, that whole racial component to it. And then just raising a child without that community of, you know, the way I grew up, you know, has really impacted her as well, you know, not in a good way. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Judith, thanks for sharing that experience. Mushroom, I don't know if you have a reaction to what you're hearing from Judith.
Yes, Judith, I'm sorry that's been your experience. I mean, that obviously comes up and came up in my interviews in so many ways. I mean, personally, I came also as a teenager and I rejected my Russian heritage, actually. I pretended that I don't speak Russian. I started having American friends, but actually not even so much American, but other immigrant friends, and we were speaking English. I did not want to speak Russian in public. I was looking down at the foods that I was eating at home. But that all kind of flooded back first when I moved out of my home, and I started really missing all of that. Mm-hmm. And Definitely when I became a parent myself, I just really started celebrating it. But again, that a lot of it just comes down to the community. It's so important to find, you know, like Dr. Gavidia was saying, representation, and not just representation of immigrants or, you know, multiculturalism or multi-ethnic representation around us. It's a lot of times it's kind of like slapstick presentations, right? Oh, look at that person. He has an accent, or look at the funny, weird foods, right? But that's not a positive representation at all. And it definitely affects how we feel and how we build our families. I guess one example I'll also bring up is many people who came from this former Soviet Union also happen to be Jewish, who used to be persecuted, you know, in Eastern Europe for generations, basically. And many of them are even, many of them end up being reluctant, kind of rediscovering Judaism and their connection to their ancestors. I mean, also it has to do with the Soviet policy of atheism. You couldn't practice any religion at all. But there's a lot of reluctance in turning back and accepting your roots and being interested in them because of what it means and the memories and the pain that it brings up, and issues of safety as well.
Yes. We're talking about being an immigrant parent with Masha Rumer, Rajika Bhandari, Connie Chang, and Dr. Juan Gavidia, and you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. So let me read a couple more comments that are coming in. Renee writes, my husband and I are both third and first generation Americans and native English speakers, but we decided to speak only Spanish to our children at home. My Chicana grandmother was beaten at school for speaking Spanish, so mostly passed on English to my father, who consequently speaks less Spanish than I do. I went to bilingual school, so I recovered Spanish, and my children are native Spanish speakers, so they speak even better than I do. Within three generations, we have recovered the language that was beaten out of our ancestors, and I treasure my grandmother telling me before she died that my son spoke Spanish so well. I don't fault immigrant parents for yearning for assimilation, but appreciate that my children and I can talk to our family in Mexico, which is not true of some of my family. This connection to our culture has enriched our life so much. And Rahil writes, as an immigrant who came to America from Eritrea as a baby, I always had an internal conflict. My culture slash tradition at home was very much embraced, which caused me to feel separated or different from my peers at school. I would get embarrassed if my parents spoke our native language around my peers. The conflict came in the form of not being allowed to do the things my peers were doing: school dances, sleepovers, clothing. As an adult with two kids of my own now, I understand where my parents were coming from, passing down the tradition so our culture would not be forgotten. Rajika Bhandari, you have this really lovely story of compromise. I think at one point, and you had touched on the fact that you could be, or you were at one point, a bit of a tiger mom, I guess. And you described that one of the ways that this came out was you really wanted your child to learn Indian classical dance, right? Can you talk a little bit about what compromise you forged, since it sounded like she wanted none of that?
Yes, that's certainly one moment amongst many others. I think the other was language, where, as both Connie and Masha have described, it's not easy. But what happened with Indian classical dance was that, like many Indian immigrant families in the US, I felt that I had to send my daughter to an Indian community center to learn one of our traditional Indian classical dances. And so I enrolled her, and it did not go well. And I got a lot of pushback, and she had zero interest in it. And I pushed it for a while, but then ultimately had to really step back and ask myself the question that, why exactly am I doing this? Is this really because it's something that's beneficial for her as an individual, or is this really much more about assuaging my sense of holding on to some Indian traditions that I think need to be held on to? And I eventually let that one go. But what I discovered was that even though I let go of having her go through the ordeal of learning something she clearly didn't want to, there were many other ways to infuse that same sense, or a similar sense of cultural understanding. So what we instead began to do, we lived in New York City, now we live just outside. So we're very lucky to have a lot of different cultural opportunities. And so I began taking her to Indian dance performances. I began taking her to musical concerts, and that's something she's always enjoyed. it. So it was a way, the compromise was of exposing her to the artistic traditions of the culture I came from, but just in a really different way, which seemed to be working better. So yeah, that's the story about giving up on Indian classical dancing.
Well, John writes, a tradition I was happy to leave behind is how girls traditionally are treated in Korean culture. Less opportunities, less chances to lead. It's different now, but still not as good as in the U.S. Or even though women make less than men, women still have chances to lead, to have careers. As the father of three daughters, I feel they have a much better path forward here and more options. Such a lovely and interesting thought, Connie Chang, in terms of the opportunity to keep the things that you love and the things that you find most beneficial to your own child's life. I'm wondering if you could leave us with, you know, as I was hearing Rajika's story, any touching moments of connection for you at the end that have brought together the things that you've struggled with in terms of trying to connect, you know, your immigrant parents and your experience growing up as the daughter of immigrants to your children now.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. I think my dad gets, and my mom too, gets a big kick out of the fact that my kids are able to recite, you know, Tang poetry or to read a book to them in Mandarin. So it's been great to, I think, especially given the sort of hurt memories that he must have had when I was a kid and rejecting his culture, the fact that I'm working so hard to connect them now and to bring some of the culture and identity to his grandchildren is very meaningful to him. And he just loves just, you know, hanging out with my son Todd, and he'll just read him a story about, I don't know, he was reading him a story about how beans grow the other day. And my father just had this huge smile on his face. They were doing it over FaceTime because of COVID issues.
Right. But you're really pointing at the healing effect of sort of that cultural loop that you've created. Well, Connie Chang, thank you.
Thank you.
And my
it's been
thanks,
great.
Yeah, and my thanks to Dr. Juan Gavidia and Rajika Bhandari, and also to Masha Rumer for inspiring the segment with her book, Parenting with an Accent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank our listeners for sharing such sweet and touching stories about growing up with immigrant parents or being immigrant parents themselves, and Grace One for producing today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.